You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. In this podcast, we'll take a look at the healthiness of farm-raised tilapia, a fish that's growing in popularity. We'll also have an update on the salmonella outbreak now that it has affected more than 1,000 people. Finally, we'll hear a debate about epilepsy drugs and whether or not they increase the risk of suicidal thoughts and actions. As I was putting this together today, I went up to get lunch at the NPR Cafe. And what do I find but tilapia? I've eaten it a few times in the past, and the way they make it, it's pretty good. But I didn't get it today because I edited this news brief from Allison Aubrey.
The public health recommendation to eat more fish may explain why consumers are buying and eating more tilapia. It's often one of the most affordable fresh fish sold in grocery stores. But researchers say tilapia contains very low levels of omega-3 fatty acids. These are the beneficial compounds linked to heart and brain health. Scientists at Wake Forest University who conducted the study found that samples of store-bought tilapia had less than a fourth than levels of omega-3s compared to farm-raised salmon or trout. They also found that tilapia contained comparatively higher levels of other types of fatty acids, omega-6s, which are already bountiful in the typical diet. Too many omega-6s may lead to inflammation in the body. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Well, Allison joins me now in the studio to talk about tilapia and some other food issues that are in the news.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Allison. First, I want to ask you about that last line in your news spot, that too many omega-6s may lead to inflammation. What kind of inflammation are we talking about?
Okay, here's what we're talking about here. Not like the kind of inflammation, fall, sprain the ankle, get kind of swelling and inflammation. Not that. That would be acute inflammation. We're talking about something more subtle, chronic inflammation over time that you may not notice when it first sets out. It may not cause any symptoms at all, probably not. But over time, chronic inflammation can lead to damages in blood vessels, so lead to heart problems in heart and lung and joints, as well as to troubles in the digestive tract.
You also drew the distinction in your story between farm-raised salmon and trout and farm-raised tilapia. Why would there be such a difference?
Well, one difference comes from the way that the farm-raised fish are fed. So tilapia is easily farmed using a really inexpensive corn-based feed. Now, corn, as you might know, is already high in omega-6s, so it's not a surprise that if you feed fish mainly a meal made out of corn that is high in omega-6s, then they will have more omega-6s in their tissue.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the difference between omega-6s and omega-3s? I think a lot of people have heard that omega-3s are good for you, but these omega-6s, how are they different?
Well, actually, the point here is not to demonize omega-6s. The point that researchers are most interested at this time, and it is controversial, is that over time, the modern American diet has become laden in these omega-6s because we have a lot of corn in our diet, and farm-raised animals are fed a lot of corn. So it's not that omega-6s are necessarily bad. It's just that we now have an imbalance in the level of omega-6s compared to the amount of omega-3s. And that imbalance is what many researchers are looking at as this precursor to inflammation in the body.
I see. Well, you know, I was also thinking about corn feeding, and I'm old enough to remember when beef was being marketed as being corn-fed. And that was supposed to be a really good thing, but I guess it really isn't anymore, is it?
Well, it's certainly not used as a marketing tool. Mostly you would hear people marketing beef as grass-fed beef, and that simply means that the cattle's being moved around, that the cattle's eating a more natural diet of this plant-based grass, which is thought to be more beneficial, having more beneficial nutrients than having just the corn feed. So it's true that animals still are fed corn feed, but I don't think it's used for marketing cachet any longer.
Let's go from eating for nutrition to eating just for basic safety. One of the things that's been in the news for several weeks now is salmonella. And I was talking to my partner last night, and he said he thought that salmonella was always related to meat. many people out there may associate salmonella with meat. Why is it that we're hearing so much about salmonella in produce?
Well, actually, the association between salmonella and meat is that salmonella is a bacteria that thrives in the intestine of animals. So that could be farm-raised livestock. It could also be us. We are mammals, animals. And in the case where you see salmonella moving into the field, what typically happens is that somewhere along the line in animal production, there's feces on a farm or feces used for manure, and that can be contaminating the water, which can be used for irrigation of crops. So once you've got water that's contaminated with some animal feces that had some salmonella bacteria in it, that's how it moves into a produce setting. And that has been the way that salmonella has been linked to produce in the past.
So they haven't definitely pinpointed it yet, but the theory is that there's some kind of runoff water that's also being used for irrigation or for watering tomatoes and the other produce that may be implicated?
That's right. What has led them to the produce is this. They do epidemiological research. So they do interviews with people who've been sick. And then they find a group of well people who are neighbors of the sick people. And they give them each food questionnaires. And they prompt them. They ask them hundreds of questions about the food that they've eaten recently. And in this study, the reason why tomatoes stood out so early on is because an inordinate amount of people who were interviewed who'd been sick reported eating tomatoes.
And well, everyone eats tomatoes.
No, actually not. Turns out that in the control group of the people, you know, who were living nearby these people who got sick but didn't get sick themselves, they were eating tomatoes at a far lower rate than the people who'd reported getting sick. And so when they saw that statistical difference, significance in that difference between the sick and the non-sick, that's how the tomatoes became the leading suspect.
Tell us a little bit more about what we heard this past week. The FDA's extended its what would I call it, ban?
Well, it's warnings.
It's warnings on not to eat tomatoes. Is the tomato thing still in effect?
Yes, the tomato warnings remain in effect.
And what kind of tomatoes are those?
The ones that consumers are being told to avoid are the Red Round, the Roma, the Red Round, and the Plum. The ones that they're being told have never been implicated in this outbreak are the smaller, the cherry tomatoes and the vine on tomatoes.
And the grape tomatoes.
And grape tomatoes, that's right.
And now it's jalapenos and
serrano peppers. Yeah, that's right. So what's leading to that is...
But are those cooked peppers or are they raw peppers?
They're raw peppers. That's what they're saying at this time. And cooking actually will kill salmonella. The problem with that is public health advice. As FDA is weary of saying, oh, just cook it, it'll be fine, because they're fearful people won't cook it enough. But point of fact, when you cook down a food, the bacteria will die. Now, but the point here about the pepper warning is the reason why the FDA is now looking at peppers is because they found at least two clusters of people who were exposed at the same time, meaning they probably ate the same thing at the same place, and they have now reported remembering eating jalapeno peppers. That is how jalapenos have now taken a front seat in this investigation.
Well, that's about all the time we have. Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Joe.
This week, an advisory committee of the Food and Drug Administration met to consider whether a new warning label is needed on epilepsy drugs. Now, these drugs aren't just used for epilepsy. They're also used to treat migraines and other conditions. The proposed warning would tell patients about a possible link between the drugs and suicidal thoughts and actions. Back in January, the FDA warned doctors about the possible risk. But the issue now is what to tell patients about the risk. As NPR's Joanne Silberner reports, the relationship between epilepsy drugs and suicide may be difficult to establish. And already, she reports, the FDA is getting pushback on the proposed warning.
You might think that Ginny Miller, of all people, would want beefed-up warnings about a possible risk of suicidal thoughts and actions associated with epilepsy drugs. Her son Sam, who has been on the drugs for several years, tried to kill himself a year and a half ago. Miller talks to a lot of patients and parents through a listserv. She says many were scared off by a warning issued to doctors in January.
If you read the warnings on all these epilepsy medications, they scare you to death just reading the warnings that are already on there. I think people will be more scared than they need to be.
And avoid the drugs and risk the accidents or even brain damage that can accompany seizures. The FDA is asking an advisory committee to consider evidence of an 80% increase in the risk of suicidal thoughts or actions. Put another way, the FDA says 4 of every 1,000 people on epilepsy drugs say they feel suicidal or have tried to kill themselves. But neurologist Alan Ettinger is concerned. He's on the board of the Epilepsy Foundation, an interest group for people with epilepsy. He also has research grants from drug manufacturers to study epilepsy drugs.
The Epilepsy Foundation and many of us in the field of epileptology believe this is a premature move to make.
The American Academy of Neurology agrees. The problem, as with the antidepressants, is that all the FDA has to work with are studies done years ago, and patients weren't directly asked about suicidal thoughts or actions. Kelly Posner of Columbia University set up the system the agency used to analyze the data.
There are limitations to how much you can interpret from it. Specifically, it doesn't necessarily tell us that this is a causal link.
Still, the findings of a link between epilepsy drugs and suicidal thoughts and actions are statistically significant, and the FDA can only act on the information it has now. The FDA does have supporters on this, even longtime critic Sid Wolf. He's director of Health Research Group, a part of Public Citizen.
Patients are very interested in understanding and very interested in being able to use drugs that they need to use as safely as possible, as opposed to being kept in the dark and then all of a sudden some tragedy befalls them and you sort of say, well, if they had known, they would have paid attention to the early warning signals.
Complicating the question is the incidence of depression in people with epilepsy, about 30% to 50%. Depression itself can lead to suicide. Neurologist Alan Ettinger says that even though he opposes the warning, something good could come out of it.
I'm hoping that this will at least inspire clinicians to spend the necessary time that's needed to query their patients about potential depression and anxiety that many individuals are suffering from and may be disinclined to spontaneously tell their doctors.
Ettinger says neurology researchers are discussing ways to determine whether these drugs really do promote suicidal thoughts or actions, but a clear answer is years away. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
So I caught up with Joanne after the advisory committee hearing, and she joins us now. Hello, Joanne.
Hi, Joe.
So what did they decide?
The committee said no, they don't think that a warning label is a good idea to have on the labels of these drugs.
Why not?
Well, they were concerned about two things. One is, even though they agree that there is an association, that people on these drugs do tend to report suicidal thoughts and actions more frequently, they're not sure, does it really cause it or is it just somehow associated? The other concern was that if patients see these warnings, these black box warnings that are right up on top, that they'd be afraid to take the drugs. Now, these drugs can stop seizures, which can really be a very serious condition.
These drugs are used for more than just epilepsy. I think you may have mentioned that in your story, but tell us again, what are some of the common uses?
Oh, they've been used for a lot of things, for different kinds of pain, for migraine headaches. Some people prescribe them for depression. In fact, some of these drugs are used more for non-epilepsy conditions than for epilepsy. In the studies that link the drugs to suicidality or suicidal thoughts and actions, more commonly it was with epilepsy.
And just for listeners who may not be familiar with what these drugs are and they might actually be taking them, what are some of the names?
Well, Neurontin is the biggest one. It's also known as gabapentin. And then Lamictal is another one. There were a total of 11 drugs that they're concerned about. And in fact, in the data, only 8 of them were linked with suicide. The other 3, they didn't have enough data to say.
So do you think the issue's over?
No, it never is with these issues of suicidality because they are so hard to tease apart. You know, you've got these drugs that have an important benefit. Epilepsy is a tough, tough disease. These drugs have an important benefit. If there's a suicidal link, everyone wants to know about it, and there are things you can do, you know, take a different drug or be under more strict observation in the beginning. But because the data are unclear, it's not over. I think what's really needed, and I think everyone at the meeting today said this too, they need better data. They need studies that start where they look at people from the beginning, they ask them about suicidal thoughts and actions from the beginning rather than the data they had today, which was taking studies where maybe it was reported, maybe it wasn't.
Are those studies going on or any prospect of them? Or?
Good question. Drug companies don't have any need to do these new studies. Their drugs are already approved. Few people really want to finance them. There are neurologists who are talking about how can they figure this out. There's talk about new studies, but even if they're started and done, it's going to take years.
Does the FDA always listen to the advisory committees?
Not always. So as they say, time will tell.
Great. Thanks for coming in, Joanne.
Thank you, Joe.
NPR's Joanne Silberner. That's it for this podcast. I'd like to remind you that we have a series of reports going on the radio about the universal healthcare systems of five European countries. This week, we have looked at France, and I'll be posting a special edition of NPR on Health containing those reports sometime in the next few days. As always, if you want to hear more health stories, you can tune in to your local NPR station. We have a list of them at our website, npr.org. There's also some information about the health series at npr.org/health. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.